Nuestro río, el río Colorado, is regarded as the lifeline of the American Southwest. It provides water for over 30 million people, and it irrigates millions of acres of farmland. It has nurtured Native American, Hispano, and Latino people for generations. However, the real history of our people in the American Southwest began over 400 years ago when Juan de Oñate and a group of Spanish-speaking colonists pushed northward from Zacatecas, Mexico, and eventually followed the Rio Grande to the confluence with the Rio Chama, where they founded the first colony of Spanish settlers in 1598. For Nuestro Rio, I am Roberto Mondragón. It was in the Rio Grande watershed that the colonists established acequias, or irrigation ditches, in order to grow crops and survive in the arid Southwest. Esteban Arellano is a writer and farmer from Embudo, New Mexico, who understands the history of acequias.
Again, you have to go back to the land grants, because it's a land grant that really defined how people look at the land, you know. And a land grant, you can divide it in three different ways. You have the common lands, which are the ejidos, the dehesas, and montes, sierras, and all that. And then what divides the common lands from the irrigated lands is the acequia. So you have like this zigzag line dividing both lands, and it's the acequia which divides the common from the irrigated lands. When you look at the water available for the acequias, usually the water is divided here, or the, what we call in Spanish a repartimiento. It happens in July and August. The water was first turned on to the acequias around the 15th of April. And usually the way we divide the water here is that the four upper acequias get the water for 3 days of the week. Then the four lower acequias get it for 4 days, and the cycle goes back until the rainstorms begin in July or August, and then we have enough water.
The colonists gradually tapped roots into this homeland that they shared with the Native Americans, whose ancestors had lived there for thousands of years. Chuy Martinez is a músico who wrote a canción called La Indita del Río Grande.
Río Grande, generoso por tus venas aguadas. Río grande, generoso por tus venas aguadas, y alimentas a tu gente con tanto vegetal.
As time passed, Spanish priests trekked into the Southwest, building Catholic missions and exploring its waterways. In 1692, Padre Eusebio Quino oversaw the early construction of the San Javier del Bac Mission south of present-day Tucson, Arizona, near the banks of the Santa Cruz River. In 1776, Padre Francisco Dominguez y Padre Silvestre Escalante led an expedition from Santa Fe northwest into present-day Utah, where they crossed the Colorado River searching for a trail that might lead them across the desert to the missions in California. They were forced to return to Santa Fe, but they were certainly among the first Hispanos to see the northern Colorado River. In 1829, Antonio Armijo, a New Mexican trader, mounted an expedition along what became known as the Old Spanish Trail from Santa Fe to Los Angeles. One of the members of his party was a 14-year-old boy named Rafael Rivera. Angelica Maralazon from the Southern Nevada Water Authority tells this story.
He came with an expedition of Aramijo, but the significance of Rafael Rivera, he was the first non-Indian Latino to actually had set foot in this area. He went off the expedition. He kind of got lost, I think by choice. And then that's when he said, oh, there's all that Las Vegas over there, meaning the meadows. And that's where the name came from. And that's the significance of his role in the history of Las Vegas.
Nathan Harper is the staff archaeologist at the Springs Reserve in Las Vegas, Nevada.
And so Rafael Rivera, from all accounts, left the main body of Armijo's group and did some scouting on his own over the course of several days across Christmas and New Year's. and then returned to the group and told them about it. You know, John Fremont traveled through as well. He was here in 1844, I believe, and identified the springs as well and wrote up a report saying that, you know, that they came to a large pool of water and they rested for several days, but the water itself was really too warm to be really refreshing. The Big Springs complex became a major stop on the old Spanish trail between Santa Fe and points west.
By the 19th century, Hispanos began to move out of the Rio Grande watershed over the continental divide into the Colorado River watershed. Jose Martinez's ancestors settled in Caracas, New Mexico, where the old Spanish trail crosses the San Juan River into Colorado.
So what they grew there, according to my mom, was the blue corn that they made into atole and shakewe. And then they had the mais concho that they made the hominy out of. Then they had the sweet corn that they made chicos out of. And then they had all those vegetables, everything from onions to chilies. I remember grandma having cauliflower and cabbage, chili seeds. They planted them in March on the tubs where the sun would hit them or where it was warm close to the stove. And they had transplants that big when they put them in the ground.
Farm workers from Mexico began to migrate into the Colorado River watershed to work in the fields of the Imperial Valley and other irrigation districts along the river and beyond. Chuy Martinez went to work in the fields as a young boy.
New water will come when they release the water, like for example for some of the ditches that were to irrigate the fields. It was so cool because we could freshen up, take a little break and then go and freshen up. Because we have to remember that back then there was no child labor laws that were passed. Even before the Carter days, there was laws against the child labor. We were still working in the fields. We would just go early in the morning by 5 o'clock in the morning, and then by 10 o'clock when they alerted the mayordomos or the patrones that the inspectors will come, then we were taken out of the field.
The farm workers were underpaid, overworked, forced to live in labor camps where their living conditions were marginal at best. In the 1950s, a new voice of hope came to be heard from within the migrant farm workers, the clear voice of Cesar Chavez, who became a great hero within the Chicano movement. Ricardo Garcia was a friend of Cesar Chavez.
Cesar Chavez exemplified that phrase of si se puede. What had happened historically with the Mexican-American community was severely conditioned to behave in ways that did not bring out their talents. They were left out of educational opportunities, victims of discrimination simply because their ancestry went back to Mexico, and because, well, they spoke a different language, which was Spanish, simply because they were never given the opportunity to an education. Cesar Chavez comes along, and he's a unique person. He understands these things, I believe, and he begins to challenge, and he begins to also get training. You know, that training is very important to building up one's confidence. That's what happened to Cesar. But he took it one step farther in that he had this natural talent to lead, to organize, and he used those experiences to begin to challenge that industry in California. And workers were waiting for a person of that stature to follow. They were the workers that had been forgotten by the labor movement. Chavez exemplified the courage, you know, to stand up and to say, I am somebody, we are somebody, we can do some things if we march in solidarity, if we belong to a union. He chose a union structure to do that. One gets to know Cesar Chavez. He's for real. He is a very intelligent, very well-read man, and he used to read a lot. He is a hero because he did manage to form a union, and it's still there. It has membership. We were talking about workers who were also discriminated because of race and or national origin. It answers many of the questions as to why some things didn't happen you know, the consequences, which can be so detrimental when that happens to a group of people, that because they're different, they're treated differently or excluded from this notion that we have of the American dream.
Cesar Chavez and his great friend and colaboradora Dolores Huerta founded what was to become the United Farm Workers Union that had up to 100,000 members. Dolores Huerta continues to be one of the great leaders among the Hispano Latino people.
Cesar Chavez and I both came out of a group called the Community Service Organization that was organized by a wonderful human being, Fred Ross Sr. Fred Ross organized in San Jose, California, and that's where he found Cesar Chavez. And I, living in Stockton, was organized by Fred in a house meeting in Stockton, California. So Cesar and I both worked in that organization, and we left the organization to start the union. The Community Service Organization was going to support our organizing project, but at the convention they voted us down. So Cesar and I left, and we started the United Farm Workers. It was then the National Farm Workers Association, which when we merged with the AFL-CIO became the United Farm Workers of America. Cesar was very, very intelligent. He only went to the eighth grade, but he was really very, very smart. And, he was more than smart. I put him on the genius level in terms of the kind of person that he was, and very, very committed, disciplined, focused, just a great human being. I mean, he literally gave his life, you know, for the movement. And humble, people would say to Cesar, you're the leader of the Chicano movement. And he'd say, no, he said, I'm the president of the Farm Workers Union. And he was always embarrassed when he was always honored, because he felt that the honors needed to go to the people, to the farm workers, to the volunteers that built a movement, not to him as a person, but he was totally the inspiration. When we consider what the farm workers movement was, what you had hundreds of volunteers, people that worked for $5 a week, they didn't get paid. People that dropped out of school, left their, you know, businesses and whatever to come and work full-time for the movement. But that's how much people believed in his leadership.
Again, Chuy Martinez.
Well, that was one of the biggest parts of the Cesar Chavez movement, the union movement, was because they had been polluting the fields for so many years. All that used to go into the stream, the water stream. All the pesticides, not only that had endangered the land, but also the people. We have to remember that a lot of those, including myself and some other, a lot of people that I knew, I remember we used to try to find a little clear puddle that we could go and get water, because water was pretty scarce in the fields. One of the biggest things for the union, or the first things, was the fight was against the big polluters, the strain, the herbicide, and of course a lot of the, to have fresh water for the people in the fields. And sanitary conditions were bad, and of course fertilizers, you name it. I mean, there were so many chemicals that were being sprayed and applied on a daily basis, and people had to endure those. Around that time was also a lot of the braceros from the bracero program, which was a Mexican kind of temporary job program, where these people would come and work for a season, you know, months, and of course they went back. A lot of them suffer the consequences, because that was one of the heaviest. They were still using DDT, you know, which is banned all over the world, and so some parts of the world still use it. These people had endured a lot of those chemicals and suffered from them.
Again, Dolores Huerta.
With the United Farm Workers, we did a lot of work on pesticides. We were able to get many pesticides banned, starting with DDT. We got this other organization, the California Rural Legal Assistance, to file a lawsuit on DDT. This was way back in 1968 or 69. We were able to get parathion banned, which is a very deadly organic phosphate, and several others, Dynaseb. In fact, the Dynaseb remains of that pesticide were actually leaking into the water table, and had already gone through two levels of the water table, and we're going into the third one, which would have been the drinking water table. So we were able to get that. But altogether, the United Farm Workers, we were able to get about a dozen of the pesticides banned.
Susana De Anda speaks of the poisoned waters of Central California.
And I'm the co-director, co-founder of Community Water Center. The reason the center exists is because in California we have thermal conditions when it comes to drinking water. We're living in a crisis, so over 90% of our valley residents rely on groundwater. However, our groundwater is heavily polluted through a number of practices. By far, the contaminant we're seeing in our drinking water are nitrates. The biggest source of nitrate contamination are coming from animal manure, leaky septic tanks, and also chemical fertilizer applications. Nitrates not only are harmful to your health, they can cause a number of types of disease, and also the blue baby syndrome. For example, if a baby who's 6 months of age ingests highly nitrate-contaminated drinking water, the blood is unable to actually absorb oxygen, so it turns blue. So that's why it's the blue baby syndrome. What that means on the ground is that many of our residents are having to pay twice for water, for a water bill, but just to use for daily things like flushing the toilet, washing their laundry, they still have to buy additional drinking water, so it's bottled water or vended water.
Lupe Martinez is a Latino environmental activist whose roots go back to the United Farm Workers Union.
My goal that we start really having the younger generation coming in. It is moving. We usually do what we call toxic tours, and we have people come from LA, different places and organizations who want to know more about these communities and what are those contaminations or what's going on. For example, in Arvin, there's a site there that's contaminated. Actually, it's a Superfund site, which EPA is responsible in cleaning, but they haven't cleaned it for the last 30 years. So we're applying the pressure right now on EPA to clean it, and they've finally started to figure out how they're going to close that well and where they're going to put a new well for the community for drinking water, because that's getting very threatened right now.
Today, management of the Colorado River watershed is one of the most complex issues in the Southwest. In 1922, the Colorado River Compact was signed into the law of the river, where each of the seven states was to receive its annual allocation of acre feet of water. The watershed was divided into the upper basin and the lower basin, the dividing line set at Lee's Ferry, just downstream from the Glen Canyon Dam. The upper basin states of New Mexico, Colorado, Wyoming, and Utah were free to equitably divide the water between those states. The lower basin allocation, Arizona, Nevada, and California, was far more complex because of a far greater human population, so complex that the mayordomo of the river is none other than the Secretary of the Interior. Congressman Raul Grijalva from Tucson, Arizona, tells us something about the work of our present Secretary of the Interior, Ken Salazar, who grew up in the northern Rio Grande watershed of the San Luis Valley in southern Colorado.
When we were going through this whole issue with the Grand Canyon, and the opposition from the mining industry has been intense, Salazar kept talking about water through this whole thing, the dependency and equitable distribution. And so when he recommended that his preferred option was that 1 million acres be withdrawn from any mining around the Grand Canyon, and that would be the next study area. That was possibly one of the boldest decisions that Secretary Salazar has done in his tenure. A lot of what we do has to be based on fact and science, you know, and I think if we did more of that, we'd be in better shape. But there's also an instinct in a historical context and a cultural context. And I think that historical cultural context flavored the urgency of the way Secretary Salazar looked at this issue. Because I was very, very pleasantly surprised by how vast the withdrawal option that he recommended was.
The Colorado River is one of America's greatest recreation areas. Poet Iris Cushing worked as an artist in residence with the Stuart L. Udall Parks in Focus program. She worked with a group of Hispano children. Here, they perform a song they wrote collaboratively that tells of their Grand Canyon adventures.
As I was walking, I saw the river. It was so shocking, I began to quiver. I snapped a picture of a brown otter. At the Grand Canyon we did see. Down the trail, we saw a
New Mexico Congressman Ben Ray Lujan grew up in the shade of an ancient cottonwood tree beside an acequia that has watered the homeland of his ancestors in northern New Mexico for well over a century.
When you go back to when the acequias came to be, back into the 1500s, and the historical perspective that that place, going back to what it means for the pueblos, what it meant when the Spanish came in, the governance associated with the development of this acequia structure. These are hand dug and they're maintained by hand year after year. Every spring you get together and you clean. And whether it's the young kids that your responsibility was taking water and making sure everyone had water, to where you were old enough to carry the pala, that shovel, and actually carve it, but making sure that you never infringed on those banks. Ditches, the acequias that we're carving, were the same ones that were being carved 400 years ago. And you take that into consideration with the importance of the historical value of living in the high desert and what this water has meant.
La Virgen de Guadalupe is a patron saint of the Americas. Eulogio Ortega is a santero, a woodcarver who constructed a chapel to La Virgen de Guadalupe in his own orchard.
La Virgen of Guadalupe is very important in this area. The story goes back in Mexico over 500 years ago. So some of the settlers that came from Mexico, they started building churches, you know, in honor of Our Lady of Guadalupe and making statues. When the first settlers came here, the first thing that they did was build their homes. And then after their homes, they would build a chapel that was located more or less in the center of the community. Our Lady of Guadalupe became very, very popular. There's quite a few churches that are dedicated to Our Lady of Guadalupe. And the Catholic Church here in Velarde is dedicated to Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Dr. Silvia Rodriguez grew up in Taos, New Mexico, and has written an important book titled Acequia, Water Sharing, Sanctity, and Place.
Underlying this sort of ethic of sharing the water is a moral economy that isn't simply visible in irrigation and water sharing practices. There's ideal culture and real culture. I mean, people know they're supposed to share the water, but they fight over it and they steal it all the time, but they know what they should be doing. But that looking then at particularly the focus of the San Isidro Función, but then there are these others, you know, like San Juan and immersing yourself in the water, looking carefully at the prayers, and participating fully in this whole thing, is that the moral economy is also very apparent here, which is, you know, what are the saints and what are the teachings in association with San Isidro and what exactly goes on in the novenas and what are the prayers and the texts of the prayers? And then people carry these saints. What is a procession anyway, but a kind of, you know, prayer in motion, but it's also a kind of topographic ritual. It's like the attachment to place and the location of these chapels. And so I was making an argument about place, the sacralization of place through ritual practice, through, you know, prayer and song, through alabanzas, and that there was also a kind of moral and ethical teaching that involved one generation after another, because you had several generations participating in this. And it was the same folks. I mean, the same folks who carry the saints through the fields are the same people who irrigate or the same people who share the water.
Again, Esteban Arellano.
There's so many things. You know, I wrote a poem in Spanish once called El Silencio Ruidoso. Because when I go up into the arroyo, you know, it seems like it's so silent. And then after being there about 5 minutes, there's more noise there than anything else. There's the crickets. There's the coyotes. There's the birds fluttering around. It's not that solitude that's completely silent, but it's a solitude full of noise. All these creatures are communicating with you. And so are the trees, because the trees, if there's a little breeze, you know, you can see the weeds move, you know, the willows, whatever there are, you know. And that's why I say I can't see myself, separating myself from nature. And I understand it, intellectually understand wilderness and that it has to be protected. But still, down deep in my heart, I say, how can I do that? That's part of the watershed that you were talking a while ago about the watershed. That's why I divide the watershed from La Sierra, Los Montes, Los Llanos, you know, the dehesas where people used to go pasturing their animals. So all these concepts are all interrelated. So for me, that's why I am very proud now to be a mestizo, because I don't have to draw on only one culture, but I can draw on all these different cultures as to why I think the way I think, what I eat, the way I eat, where the foods come from. And to me, it makes my life a lot richer, you know.
Es mi orgullo haber crecido entre frijol, chile y maíz.
Author Devon Peña has a 200-acre farm in the San Luis Valley of southern Colorado. He is the founder of a new organization called the Acequia Institute, and he is interested in restoring the concept of the commons as it has existed in Hispano water law for centuries.
For the land to work as a common, you need something else. It's not enough to just have the land. You need an intellectual common. You need traditions of mutual aid. You need what I call mutual reliance interests as opposed to individual utilitarian interests. You need cooperative labor and all of the traditional ethno-ecological knowledge necessary to pull all those together. So without the knowledge, there is no common. Because who's going to make the rules? Who's going to pass down the ethics from one generation to the next? Things will fall apart. So it's not enough to have a legal definition or precise boundaries for a common property resource, for a common. You've got to have the intellectual common, the cultural ecological commons, as I like to call it, the ethno-ecological, agro-ecological knowledge, and the land and water ethics that are transmitted from one generation to the next via that knowledge. Without that, there is no common.
In the late 20th century, a tunnel was created beneath the continental divide so that water could be pumped through the San Juan Chama diversion from the Colorado River watershed to the Rio Grande watershed. Today, these two great watersheds of the American Southwest are connected by both the transfer of water from one side of the continental divide to the other, and by an enduring Hispano-Latino community whose roots were tapped into the soil of the Southwest 20 generations ago. Dr. Enrique Lamadrid speaks of querencia, our tie to our homeland.
Querencia is a folk concept. It's a sense of belonging. It's a sense of rootedness. Querencia is the place where you know you belong. It's a place that you love. It's a place that you want to be. It even has a sense of the place that you prefer to die in.
La Sierra Sangre de Cristo te enseña su corazón a nacer.
Anna,